south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
You know, the more you learn about the Spanish language and the more you speak it and study it, the more you find out it's a lot more logical and predictable than the English language. In fact, I understand there are a third less words in the Spanish dictionary than there are in the English dictionary. So that makes it, according to Billy Shakespeare anyway, a language that's not fully as expressive as the English language. So that's why English writing and English lit is so much deeper and profound, or can be anyway, than Spanish literature. And by the way, when Shakespeare is translated into Spanish, and it is, well, it's just not the same, and any fully bilingual person will tell you so. Hey, but you don't want to say that in front of a bunch of so-called educated Spanish or Latino folks who are not bilingual, because it upsets them. Unfortunately, the truth can be an ego crusher. The fact is, you longtime listeners have heard me say this on a show at one time or other anyway, that if you check the list of the 100 greatest literary masterpieces of all time, and you know, if you do a search, and I hate Google, so do it on StartPage or DuckDuckGo, first thing you'll find is there are a lot of very educated people who have chimed in on that 100 great books list, but you'll find, oddly enough, only one Spanish novel turns up on that list, and that would be, of course, Don Quixote. So consistently, Spanish literature hits 1 out of 99 of the greatest books in the world, so that kind of says it all. And funny enough, I've had this little discussion many times at so-called high-end Latin parties where intellectuals and stuck-up pseudo-intellectuals are hanging and holding court. And you know, it figures. When that Don Quixote statistic comes up, they just don't want to believe it. And instantly, they'll throw out some other so-called famous Spanish authors like Pablo Neruda and a lot of other people practically no one in the first world has ever heard of. So why aren't they on the great books list? I wonder. So when you bring up the fact that Spanish authors hold about 1% of the great books market, naturally those Latino literary defenders will deny those statistics left and right. But they've all got smart devices, and we can check it right there. So you can go right online and pull up a dozen lists of the so-called 100 most famous works of literature. And for the Spanish literary influence, all you'll find is Don Quixote. And let me tell you, when you're in a room full of so-called educated, high-class Latinos, that gets their dander up. And that's when nationalism and love of culture and country kicks in, and you can't argue against that because it's illogical. They throw that same stale cultural bias argument at you that minority groups often use when the subject of diversity and worldwide IQs comes up. You know the drill. They shout out that tests are culturally biased in favor of white privilege and all that. Until you bring up the fact that the Japanese and the Chinese have higher IQs than the so-called people of Western European heritage. Then, of course, they've got no comeback for that one. Because, you know, if the tests really were culturally biased towards white people, they certainly wouldn't let the Japanese or the Chinese get the upper IQ hand, would they? Oh, and by the way, IQ tests have been around, what, 100 years now? In fact, the U.S. government and the military have been measuring IQs on soldiers and bureaucrats since before World War II. And there's mega data and mega analysis. In fact, the last I checked, there have been over 10,000 scientific papers and research projects done on IQ, with over 4,000 books written. Of course, none of us have ever read any of them. Though, maybe they read that one entitled The Bell Curve, which was sort of popular a couple dozen years ago now. I read that one myself. Just shows you how much interest and study have gone into that theme. And the tests over the years have been so analyzed and refined that any accusation of cultural bias falls along the wayside if you do the search and you find out how they've eliminated those biases. Because the subject of cultural bias in IQ tests came up in the 50s and 60s, and since then, reams of psychologists, sociologists, and statisticians have made it their life's work to eliminate cultural bias in IQ tests. So really, you'll hear that argument only from the uninformed, non-didactic, bleeding hearts who would wish the IQ distribution of all cultures was equal across the board. But it just ain't true. So what am I talking about this for? Well, that's because a couple of shows ago when I mentioned the differences in general IQ across cultures, I got the requisite hate mail. Ah, but I knew I would. Like my good old Uncle Bernie used to say, Johnny, if you've got no enemies, you're living a life of mediocrity, like French fries without ketchup, like a potato without salt. And wasn't it Socrates that said, knowledge brings sadness? And of course, in the Bible it says somewhere, with much knowledge comes much grief. So is it better to know things and see the world with a tinge of sadness, even grief, or be a happy moron? Well, obviously, if you're listening to this show, you're thinking about a plan B, most likely in Latin America. So you listeners out there are not happy morons. Anyway, I started this rant by talking about how the Spanish language is a little bit more direct, has less words, which means in Spanish, of course, there are fewer ways to compliment a person or tell him he's a moron, because you've got a much more limited choice of words than you do in English. Plus, Spanish words are phonetically pronounced, unlike many words in English, which makes English a lot more difficult to learn than Spanish. Not to mention, English has more rules and exceptions to those rules. Like, for example, I before E, except after C. No such animal in Spanish. And thankfully, a lot of words in Spanish sound much like their counterparts in English. They call them cognates, C-O-G-N-A-T-E-S, which is a nice crutch when you're first getting started learning the language. For example, here's a good one. If, let's say, you're driving down the street and there's a Latin girl in the passenger seat, you pull to a stop sign and you see a guy pissing right there on the corner, as certainly half the Latin population of men will do when they happen to get the urge. So anyway, you're at the stop sign and the Latina in the passenger seat is likely to say something like, "Qué grosero." Now, the operative word there is grosero. Looks and sounds pretty much like the English word gross, and that's exactly what it means. So hey, what English speaker is going to misinterpret what she's just expressed? By the way, every time that happens, meaning every time I see a guy whipping it out on the street, and I'm with a Latina or Latinas who obviously look at that with some disgust, you know, qué grosero. Depending on the situation, I like to point out to them that it's not his fault. You know whose fault that is? His mother and his grandma, his abuela, and every woman in the house he grew up with. And when I say that, they always seem to give me a puzzled look that says, explain yourself. And I say, look, I grew up in a family with a lot of kids and a very strict and demanding mother. And I'll tell you this, if I ever tried something like that, my mom would go into the kitchen drawer and get out that big-ass wooden spoon and tan my backside. So I'll say to the girl, what I'm saying, chica, is you and your mothers and your grandmothers allow the grosero males in your family to be grosero. Same thing with the Latin male epidemic of spitting whenever they have the urge. And if and when I do get resistance from Latin ladies on that point, I'll say, look, how often do Latin ladies spit? How often do they just relieve themselves in public when they have the urge? How about never? But you let your men and boys do it at the drop of a hat. So I'll ask you again, whose fault is it? And you know, not so long ago, I had this conversation with a quite beautiful, upscale, and sort of entitled Latina. She inferred that the people of her class, of her status in education, didn't do that kind of stuff. It was the lower, uneducated classes who did. She even went so far as to say she'd never go out with a guy who did that. Then she added she never saw her boyfriend spit or take a leak in public, and if he did, she'd break up with him. Now, of course, I was talking to an upscale Latina whose parents had some dough, and she had her own car and all that. Daddy bought it. And you know what I said to her? If you had a hidden camera following that guy around all day, you'd see him spit and you'd see him whip it out. He's just not doing it in front of you because he knows better. She said, oh no, he wouldn't do that, and kept insisting. But I kept pushing and I said, let me ask you this. The last time you drove to the beach on one of the big autopistas, how many cars did you see pulled over on the side of the road with a guy just doing his thing right out in the open? And don't say none. Because you know, it's a 2-hour ride. When I take that trip, I always see a half a dozen guys doing it. She said, yeah, I suppose you do see a couple. I said, did you notice they were driving cars and some of them had very expensive cars? Because, you know, the lower classes you're talking about don't drive cars. I'm talking about that higher class of society you were mentioning. And did you happen to notice they don't walk just a few steps off the road? That's all it would take to go into the bushes or behind a rock. So people wouldn't see. No, it would be too difficult to take a few extra steps, right? Oh, and here's a favorite ploy on a big highway. A guy will pull over just a little bit whip it out and do it right in the wheel well. At least they've got their back to the road. Of course, I've made my point, but sometimes it's not good to win an argument like that, if you can call it an argument, even if you know their side has a million holes in it and you can wipe the floor with them. Believe me, it's no way to make friends. But then again, there are certain people you just don't want to be friends with, so go ahead and give them both barrels, especially if they're vacuous, upscale, Latin entitled types. Then the whole exercise could be rather fun. So am I cynical enough for you today? Am I grosero? Or how about this word? Love this Spanish word. Crudo. What's it sound like and look like in English? Crude. C-R-U-D-O. Crudo. And man, does that word have a lot of uses down here. For example, if a guy has the urge and whips it out, a girl might say grosero. She might say hombre crudo, meaning coarse or low class. Crude, right? But because, as mentioned, the Spanish language has a third less descriptive words than the English language, it also has other uses. For example, suppose you order a chicken dinner and you're slicing through it and you see it's not cooked all the way through. No good, not for chicken, right? What you do is you call the waiter over and you say, can you cook this a little more? It's crudo. Of course, in English, you wouldn't say it's crude because you've got a lot of other choices of descriptive words. The point is, in Spanish, you don't have as many. Oh, and about chicken. Doesn't it seem like the vast majority of ads on TV for food are some kind of processed chicken? You know, if you watch any kind of cable or commercial TV at all, it looks like the world survives on pizza, Coca-Cola, chicken, and pharmaceuticals. Now, I'm not a chicken eater myself. I used to be until I discovered all the chemicals and such they're pumping into them, and that chickens can't even stand up on their own. Their flimsy little legs won't hold their body weight anymore, and there's something really wrong with that. You know, if there's justice after death, if there's a hell, someone besides Bill, Hillary, Obama, Soros, and the Bush clan are going to burn for all eternity, and that would be Mr. Tyson, not of boxing fame, but of chicken fame. Anyway, these days, if you look it up, you'll find people eat more chicken than any other kind of meat. And if you are what you eat, you're pretty much a freaking chicken, which is not a pleasant thought, is it? But I digress as usual, man. Did I digress? Sorry about that. Which brings us to an email of great relevance because it's a question about healthcare here in Latin America that hasn't much been talked about yet. That, along with another couple of items, so let's get to it. Says, Dear Johnny, yes, I guess I'm a dear kind of guy, aren't I? Especially today. Kind of surprised that gender-bending social warrior PC crowd hasn't banned the word dear in salutations and letters. Well, they'll get around to it, I'm sure. Anyway, we'll go with the Dear Johnny thing while we still can. Dear Johnny, the wife and I are coming down for our second time to Guatemala in the end of May. Did he say the end of May? Well, the reason why I'm getting to it now is because it got hung up in my spam box. That happens all the time. Anyway, he says, this is the second time we've used your recommended concierge ladies, and we obviously endorse them highly. Now for my questions. I just listened to one of your podcasts on Ecuador's new healthcare tax on expats. Got me thinking about the long-term stability of healthcare all through Latin America, especially pertaining to the government's ability or inability to govern and to enforce low-cost private healthcare. How do you see things playing out over the next, let's say, 10 to 20 years or both in Latin government stability and healthcare costs in general there? Then he says, one of the main reasons we are on the cusp of moving is the very low cost of insurance. However, the move doesn't make much sense at all if all Latin countries are going to be adjusting healthcare costs upward to burden the wealthy and privileged, that means expats, and eventually drive healthcare costs to first world prices. All right, before we get to the rest of his questions, let me jump in on that one. The truth is, you're going to find on the gringo tourist trail like Costa Rica, Panama, Cancun, those are good examples, that healthcare costs are around half of what you'll pay up in the States. Maybe even a little less, which seems like a great deal, but it's not the true cost of medical care here in Latin America. Problem is, on the tourist trail, the gringos have piled in for some time now. So as a result, and it did take some years, the medical establishment found out they can charge what the market will bear, and that's a lot more than what you pay for medical care when you're off the tourist trail, where they have no steady flow of gringos to gouge. And that still seems like a very good deal for gringos and expats, paying half for less than what you'd pay up in the States. I'd say it's a great deal, but it's not the deal you could get when you're off the gringo tourist trail, where you'll often find it's a fifth to a sixth of the price of first world medical care. And Richard, who writes the email, says, well, what's the use of going to Latin America if eventually all the prices and healthcare, et cetera, are going to escalate? to first world levels. Is that what's going to happen eventually? Well, first, you have to know there are a few components missing in the medical healthcare equation here in Latin America. So a few things need spelling out because people just don't get it unless you do some in-depth analysis. Number one, one of the major factors is that there is no malpractice insurance here. People don't sue. It's not a culture of lawyers and lawsuits. So your Latin doctor does not have to pay $50,000 to $100,000 a year for malpractice insurance, which, of course, up in the States is factored into your bill. That's a huge cause and effect advantage that's not going to go away. In fact, I've had that discussion with a couple of Latin doctors I know, and you know what they said? They wouldn't even know where to get coverage if they wanted. In fact, I like to tell a story of a dentist up in the States, a very good one. In fact, this person's been in the media on TV and all that, doing interviews for healthcare networks and such. A real high-class person. She gets sued minimum 3 times a year. I'm talking about a dentist now. And I think I mentioned this in a previous show, but she said they always sue for $5,000 or less because they know the insurance company will settle because it costs them more than that to send a few lawyers to write up the paperwork and go to court a couple times and sit in front of a judge. So it's a racket that does not exist here in Latin America. In fact, I challenge gringos and expats to pick up a telephone book, they still have them down here, or go on the internet and check out the list of attorneys and their specialties for any medium and large-sized Latin city. And I'll bet you won't find one, barring Mexico, of course, because you know they absorb all the U.S.'s bad habits. Anyway, you won't find one attorney that specializes in malpractice. Now, do that in the States. Up there by you, you'll find a huge percentage of lawyers are into ambulance chasing. In fact, I've even heard of stories in Chicago way back when where a lawyer will show up at the funeral home of a person who's had an accidental death just to hand out his business cards. And that happened something like 30 years ago. Man, am I glad I live in Latin America. All right, let's talk about the second thing that will always keep Latin American healthcare costs low. That's the fact that medical schools are dirt cheap compared to the States. In fact, even the highest class medical school in all of Latin America, a campus that we visit during my Expat Insider seminars, their medical school, which is the highest rated in all of Latin America, is nothing short of spectacular. You just have to see this place. In fact, it's so highly rated, if you graduate from that school and you want to take up a specialty, like, for example, endocrinology or nephrology, I know this sounds unreal, but Harvard Medical School up in the States will accept you in a graduate program without taking a single test. It's an automatic in because they know the quality of the people that graduate from that medical school. If you think that's BS, look it up. The name of the school is UFM. It stands for Universidad Francisco Marroquín. By the way, you and I know Harvard is no longer the place it once was. It produces a ton of dickhead politicians and media ass kissers. But that's coming from Harvard's liberal arts school. But in the hard sciences and medicine, they're still considered top tier. So we're talking about UFM in Central America. And what is the tuition for this highest of high-class medical schools in all of Latin America? Around $5,000 to $7,000 a year. As opposed to a well-known medical school up in the States, you're talking $50,000 to $70,000 a year. Oh, and by the way, most other medical schools in Latin America, some are good, some are mediocre, some are bad. You have to suss them out. Anyway, the average tuition, if it's private, around $2,000 a year. And your average middle-of-the-road medical school up in the States, at least 20 to 25 G's a year. So what's the significance of that? Well, that just means when a doctor graduates from medical school here in Latin America, in the vast majority of cases, he's got zero debt. Oh, and did I tell you there are no school loans in Latin America? So a kid gets out, he's got no nut to crack. And these days up in the States, when a kid graduates from medical school, look this up. You'll find he's usually between $100,000 and $200,000 in debt. And after a year, I think it's after a year, the payment plan starts kicking in and you're at least 7 to 9% on those school loans. And none of that exists here in Latin America. Another big reason. First world medical health care costs here in Latin America are so low. Now, you might be wondering, if the average Latin American family makes only $300 or $400 a month and there are no school loans, how do people afford medical school and other professional schools for that matter? Well, it's easy if your parents have dough, but that's generally not the case. So medical school students, in fact, most all school students, do it the old-fashioned way. They have full or part-time jobs. I know some of you listening to this with your entitled kids have heard of that concept once called working your way through college. Oh, but you wouldn't want to put Junior through that. You'll pay for college even if you have to mortgage the house, right? Because you remember how tough it was working your way through college. What a tragedy that was. And you're such a failure now, right? It killed your drive. Uh-huh. All right, now, reason number three. Of course, every doctor's office has a reception, a nurse, and from what I understand up in the States, normally, two or three people working on just the insurance crap. Even that dentist I know up in the States has one full-time person doing insurance crap all day long. Guess what? Here in Latin America, that person does not exist because there are so few patients with insurance, less than 5% of all people here in Latin America are covered by private medical or dental insurance, by the way. Turns out, as one dermatologist here in Latin America told me, her receptionist, who's got a lot of time on her hands, she spends, according to her boss, the doc, around 20 minutes a day doing insurance stuff. 20 minutes a day. All right, let's get back to the fact that most doctors in their offices will have a receptionist, maybe a nurse. And of course, clinics and hospitals have all kinds of nurses, technical people, and auxiliaries. Not to mention, hospitals in the States have huge insurance and claims departments, which just don't exist here in Latin America. So up by you, hospitals and clinics have tremendous labor overhead, useless labor overhead because it's mostly insurance crap, and they're paying first world going rate, which is at least 30 grand a year minimum for clerical workers in hospitals. But down here in Latin American hospitals, clinics, and doctors' offices, the going rate for clerical workers is around 400 bucks or so a month. Pull out your calculator and you'll see that's around 5 grand a year. Plus, they get virtually no benefits. So break it down. That means you could hire 5 or 6 or maybe more clerical workers here in Latin America for one up in the States. And think about this. Up in the States, an RN probably makes at least 70 grand a year. Here in Latin America, and I know a few, the experienced ones that have been in it for a while are making around, get this, 700 bucks a month. So you can hire 8 or 10 RNs here in Latin America for every RN you hire up in the States. Plus, again, the benefits are minimal down here. In fact, I like to tell the story of going to the dentist here in Latin America. You find dental hygienists just don't exist. In the States, they're making 50 to 70 grand a year, a dental hygienist. But they just don't exist down here in Latin America. What's wrong with that picture? Well, ask any dentist. He'll tell you, why should I hire a dental hygienist, which don't exist anyway, so there's really no job opportunities for him, when I can hire a dentist right out of school, a graduate dentist, for around $500 to $800 a month. In other words, and this seems unbelievable, so you have to let it sink in, down here you could hire from 7 to 10 dentists right out of school as hygienists for your practice for the cost of one hygienist up in the States. So what you're looking at with healthcare here in Latin America is a fractional multiplier effect. And it always remains in your favor because certain big expenses exist up in the States that just don't exist down here. Oh, and there's one more thing you have to learn about medicine and dentistry here in Latin America, something you've never read anywhere else, I'm sure. Because it's something you glean from living down here a long, long time and talking to people and being excessively nosy like I am. And here's something very interesting I found out from the horse's mouth, from local MDs and dentists themselves. Turns out, off the Gringo Tourist Trail, which is where you get the best deals all the time, you'll find that the dentists and doctors do not over-treat or try to upsell you while you're sitting in a chair or in their office. Now, of course, up in the States, there's two parts to that. One being doctors ordering excessive, expensive diagnostic tests just to cover their asses for lawsuits. We all know about that. And since down here in Latin America, almost no one gets sued for malpractice, doctors have no incentive to overprescribe diagnostic tests. Even better, I'd say, medically speaking, but not necessarily culturally speaking, 80% of the Latin American population would be considered poor or lower middle class by American standards. And you know, it's probably really 90%. Anyway, what that means to you and me is this. Latin physicians and dentists know their patients cannot pay for expensive procedures. They just don't have the money, savings, or resources. So as it turns out, ever since Columbus landed, stole all the gold, killed all the shamans, enslaved all the workers, and raped all the women, physicians and dentists have been on a mission to keep the cost of healthcare affordable for the lower segments of the population, which comprises most of Latin America. All right, here's a perfect example. I was at the dentist not so long ago. He said, Johnny, you got a big-ass old silver filling here on a molar tooth, and it's deteriorating. It's crapping out around the margins and the edges. Then he poked at it a while and said, does this hurt? Has this tooth ever hurt? And I said, no. I said, do what you got to do, because I'm interested in getting the silver amalgam fillings out as much as I can. Almost all my childhood fillings are replaced with more biocompatible stuff. You know the drill, little pun there. Silver amalgam fillings are 50% mercury. Not good. Anyway, the doc says to me, but, you know, we'll wait till it cracks or crumbles a little bit more, and maybe we'll put a crown on there or something, but right now you really don't need it. All right, now let's jump up north about 1,500 miles to Chicago, where a U.S. dentist would say, under the very same circumstances, let's take out that old filling and put a crown on it. Insurance will cover it, or most of it, so might as well get it done now. All right, do you see the difference? My Latin dentist, trained up in a first world as an oral surgeon, by the way, at a very prestigious school, said, let's wait. When it crumbles and bumbles, we'll fix it. Meanwhile, the dentist up in the States says, let's take it out and do a crown right now, because insurance will cover it. Well, not all of it. There'll be a copay. You get it? Latin dentists will do what's absolutely necessary to keep you in good shape. No upsells at all. Whereas a stateside dentist, they let the insurance companies sway their treatment plans way too much. Which brings me to kind of a sad story. Listen to this. Many moons ago, when I was still living in Chicago, just about to leave on my trek around the world and then eventually landing here in Latin America, I stopped at my brother-in-law's medical practice. It was lunchtime. Nobody was there. His ladies were out. Waiting room empty. So he went in his back office, shot the bull for a while, and the clock was ticking, and people started filing into his waiting room. You could hear him come in. And when I was ready to leave, he said, come here for a second, Johnny. And he cracked open his office door so that I could see his waiting room was filled. And this is what he had the balls to say to me in a whisper. He had this feces-eating grin on his face, and he said, look at that, Johnny. There's $3,000 sitting there in my waiting room right now. And you know what? For a second, I just couldn't believe my ears. I thought, God, how many money-grabbing, dickhead, professional medical people are there out there? And the worst of it was he was bragging, trying to impress me. Thank God my sister saw the light. He's not my brother-in-law anymore. She dumped him.
You've been listening to the Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, you can schedule a one-on-one phone call with me. But first, download my free Plan B questionnaire at www.thenewexpat.com. Better yet, if you want to get your Plan B going from right up there in the States, just sign up for my 9-hour Expat Essentials course. Get the perfect Plan B blueprint by going to theexpatfiles.com/academy.